Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life.
Welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Jeremy.
I'm Lyle.
And today we are talking to Lou Agresta of Grimmer Space. That is a sci-fi horror setting for Starfinder, and we wanted to learn a little bit more about it today. So hello, Lou.
Hey, how are you doing, guys?
Good. Thank you for taking the time today. And so what is Grimmer Space?
Grimmer Space is awesome.
Grimmer
Space is a sci-fi horror setting for Starfinder, like you said. But the central conceit of the setting is that magic has invaded a science-only galaxy, a science-only horror galaxy, for the first time. Mm. And in particular, magic is coming through a space-time tunnel that connects back to the default Starfinder role-playing game setting. And it's leaking into Grimmer Space, and with it come these evil wizards called the Sunder Mages, who look around and they say, there's no magic here. It's going to be easy. But little do they know that the Grimmers have been dealing with things just as horrible since the dawn of their civilization. And they look up and they say, oh, really, buddy? Lock and load. How about I shoot you in the neck? How about that? And so it pits science fantasy and science fiction against each other, or bullets versus fireballs, so to speak.
Very compelling setting.
Thank you. Definitely. We're working hard to make it so, and it winds up being something that you can play any number of ways. You know, you can play it connected to the default Starfinder role-playing game setting. And I apologize. My license means I have to say it that way. I'm not allowed to use the proper nouns that are Paizo's IP. So it's a mouthful. The default role-playing game, Starfinder role-playing game setting, you can come from there. And as we like to say, you can be Ravenlofted into Grimmer Space. You could also be the children of Starfinder default role-playing game setting races and classes who were Ravenlofted and wound up settling, and now enough of a generation has gone by that their kids have grown and ready to go adventuring. You can play the Grimmers from the science-only world dealing with their alien horrors and play it as if they've never heard of the default Starfinder role-playing game setting. A lot of different ways to play this out.
And so what was your biggest motivation to choose the system for Starfinder?
Well, it's twofold, actually. Roan Barton, my compatriot, my co-owner and co-creator, who couldn't join us tonight, he and I have been writing for Pathfinder, Paizo Projects, and tabletop role-playing game industry for, between us, it's got to be 30 years worth of experience doing it over the past 15 years or so. We had a lot of experience in the Pathfinder role-playing game. We've collaborated a lot in that arena. And then when we began to fiddle with the notion of doing a science fiction setting, it was an easy transition for us to move over to Starfinder, just because of the similarities of the system. And also all of our industry contacts and all of our industry partnerships and the people who had hired us in the past and the people that we knew, they were all, for the most part, not entirely, but for the most part, in the Pathfinder Paizo realm. And their assistance has turned out to be really, really critical. Our fellow third-party publishers like Rogue Genius Games or the Open Game Network or Adventure a Week or Legendary Games. I could go on with a list. I'm sure I'm Monty Cook Games. I'm sure I'm forgetting people at the moment and they're all going to yell at me afterwards. But the industry's just come out in support and either offered us resources or allowed us to get in contact with their audiences or become writers on the project. I don't think we would have been able to come out as big and bold and loud as we have without their support.
Yeah, it has been pretty, like a really bold rollout. Like a lot of stuff is in this Kickstarter. It's not like one book.
That's great.
Yeah. It's a real...
Correct. Technically, it's our first Kickstarter. It's our first Kickstarter as Iron Jam Games. We've been involved with and salvaged other people's Kickstarters and certainly done a lot of Kickstarter work. But to be certain that we were going to get it absolutely right, we partnered up with Modiphius Entertainment in the UK. They've done some amazing Kickstarters and amazing delivery on that. They do the Conan role-playing game, the John Carter Warlord of Mars, the Star Trek. Chris Birch over there has been an invaluable partner. They'll be our distribution partner, but they've also been our Kickstarter consultants. Gamerati is our Kickstarter manager, and I think they've done something like 1,700 Kickstarters. I mean, some some stupid, crazy number. So we tried to surround ourselves with experts so we didn't make any mistakes.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. And you can tell too. I mean, you're getting a lot of great attention and the scale of the Kickstarter, I think, is very striking for people. It doesn't look like your first time, like a first time Kickstarter.
Right. Like I said, it's ours, but everyone we're working with, it's not their first. So
why do you think the Grimmer Space setting has like caught on the way it has? Like I've seen like Starfinder players like getting really excited about the setting, but then I've also seen people who weren't that interested in Starfinder, but they're like, oh, what's this?
Right. Maybe I'll pull my Starfinder off the shelf and give it a try.
Yeah. Yeah. Or pick up Starfinder to give this a try. Yeah.
We've also had a startling number of people, to us startling, who have said, well, I've never done Kickstarter before, but now I'm going to.
Oh, really? Wow.
So like a lot of first time Kickstarter people. So we're answering a lot of questions about how Kickstarter works, which is fine. It's exciting that we were enticing enough. So why that enticing? I think two reasons. I think we hit a note. We hit a resonance. The default Starfinder role-playing game setting is, if you were to compare it to cinema, I would say it's very Guardians of the Galaxy in flavor and tone. And that's great. It's one of my favorite movies. But it's a very specific flavor. And if you wanted something that was a little darker or a little more adult or a little more edgy, that's, you're not going to get it, generally speaking, is I think the consensus feeling. So when we said we're doing Starfinder like you've never seen it before, we're going to walk right up to the edge of our compatibility license and put our toes on the rated R line without crossing it. And we're going to handle this more serious, darker content or more serious horror content. I think we weren't the only ones who wanted that, is really what it boils down to. Mm-hmm. I also think there's a timing confluence. The Starfighter role-playing game came out almost 3 years ago. It sold gangbusters. And my suspicion is most people bought it and a bunch of books and stuck them on their shelves. And only about 20% of the games being played with a Paizo system are active, or have been until now, active Starfinder games at the table. That's the game we go to and we play that every week.
Yeah.
I think most people were playing Pathfinder, and then when somebody couldn't make it, they're like, well, let's play a session of Starfinder. And the reason, I think, is really simple. Everyone loves it, loves the idea in the Pathfinder world, wants to give it a go. But when it came out, it doesn't mean anyone had finished their current Pathfinder AP or campaign. Mm-hmm. So campaigns can run a couple years. So now we get 2 years later, and I think everyone's campaigns that were going on at the time are starting to wrap up. Mm-hmm. And people are saying, what are we going to do next? Suddenly in their face is, well, how about this dark horror Starfinder setting, the campaign? Why don't you do this next? And it's coinciding with people being ready to say, hey, this has been sitting on my shelf long enough. Let's give this a serious whirl. And then I don't really think there's another space. There are a couple of excellent sci-fi systems out there. There are not many excellent sci-fi horror systems out there. So I think we're one of very few options in a market that people are interested in. So I think these three things come together.
That's great. Yeah, that is very lucky timing. So was that intentional or just kind of good luck, that kind of the two-year span where people would be looking for another setting after the original Adventure Path?
It was a combination of both. We sat down to make our feasibility assessment. The result was that analysis that I just dumped on you with far too many words. my God, when is this guy going to stop talking about the industry? And we said, hey, I think the timing's about right. You know, maybe give or take a year. So that went into our assessment of whether this was the thing we should do instead of trying something else.
Hmm.
And the answer was, yeah, I think the timing's about right, you know, plus or minus a year. Not exactly sure where the wave is, where in the curve we are. And then we had some internal issues that delayed the project. We were waiting to see if an additional celebrity presence would be with us like they said they would. Mm-hmm. And during those delays, as we waited around for this person, we just kept working on the setting and working on the system and making it richer and making it better. And when we finally said, look, we can sit around waiting for someone who doesn't really seem like they're going to show up, like waiting for Godot play an RPG, or I couldn't resist, or, you know, we can go give people the game that they said they wanted and that we promised them we'd make. When you look at it that way, it's sort of like, yeah, all right, it's a no-brainer. We're going to go make a game. But that delay wound up making us a lot stronger. And I think that's the accidental part that made the timing even more precise.
That's great.
Well, you say you're one of the, like, the only SF horror options out there, or the good SF horror options out there.
Not the only, but, you know.
Yeah, one of them. Yeah. When you're designing a horror game in particular, like, what do you consider?
Well, there's a couple of considerations and that make it extra challenging for an RPG. One of them is that so much of horror is dependent upon helplessness and isolation. And so much of gaming is never split the party and we're going to be heroes. So that tension has to be addressed. And we've addressed it by saying that our core setting, the Gliding Rim Galaxy, which is where we get G-Rim or Grimmer Space, alien horrors are just intrinsic. They're part of the setting. Horror is not even just alien, but every single aspect of the setting, we ask ourselves the question as we design, where's the horror? So everything reflects some aspect of horror, and the people there, or the players there ultimately, have been dealing with that. That's just par for the course. And so the design factor is rising above to be able to face that horror.
Right.
What we also did, and I wish Roan was here for this, because he's an amazing, he's not just a cinephile, he's an encyclopedia of film. And he's written a series of essays on what is horror in Grimmer Space. And these are being handed out to our writers as they come on board. And I've said in other podcasts, I'll say it again, I'm going to encourage him eventually to publish these because I think they're that great.
Good.
But we've identified, for our purposes, 15 different kinds of horror, or subgenres of horror. And we hope to explore most, if not all of them, in Grimmer Space over time. This is not this first Kickstarter, we don't intend it to be a one-off. And there's a wide range of arenas to explore. And one of them, for example, might be war horror. When you're badass and you've been taking out your enemies and fighting a war and you think you're tough as nails, and in the middle of that, you come up against something supernatural that leaves you going, what? It really is a subgenre that you'll find in film. The most recent example of that, I think, is the movie Overlord, if you caught that one.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
There's a good example of war horror. Or The Keep is an older one. So breaking horror down into its subgenres and identifying every adventure with what subgenres are involved is one of the things that we opted to do to handle horror in Grimmer Space.
That's good. Yeah, I saw the reference to that in the Kickstarter, that the setting can be dialed to your preference in horror. So if, you know, it's slasher and gore, or more psychological or tense.
Or cosmic, or
nice. And session length as well. Was that a difficult thing to do, to determine like how much you were going to include in this first Kickstarter and in the first adventure?
No, it wasn't difficult in so much as it was a from the beginning design goal. Meaning, as we first talked about it and said, so we're going to do sci-fi, but not just sci-fi meets science fantasy. It's got to be sci-fi horror, because there has to be some oomph, some juicy that can be the equivalent of magic, the counterpart to magic. And so we went sci-fi horror. The moment that we said that, we said, okay, well, what is that going to mean? How are we going to do that? Because, wow, there's a lot of problems with that. Some people, as Roan say, slasher fiction is the redheaded stepchild of horror. Usually done poorly, and a lot of horror aficionados will sneer at it. Of course, anything done consummately will rise above that crowd there, but that's not everyone's cup of tea. Mm-hmm. So how are you going to handle that? And what about cosmic horror? How do you do that with that while staying original and not just mimicking Lovecraft, for example, or psychological horror or super? And as we're talking about that, we said, hey, you know what? We better go out there and do some research and decide for ourselves what the subgenres of horror are that we're going to handle, how we're going to handle them, and how we're going to accommodate people's differing tastes and desires. And if we can't solve that problem, we shouldn't do this project.
Oh, wow.
So it was the first thing we tackled, you know, making and necessary to tackle to our satisfaction before we could move forward. So we did that. And we said, as we were doing it, we said, well, we were also talking to various online groups and doing polls and a little bit of focus testing and asking people what they wanted and what they didn't want to get a sense of temperature reading on where people were at with Starfinder. And one of the things that came out is people were like, oh, these long APs. I don't want that so much right now. And I think Paizo's recognized that too. They've shifted to shorter APs. So we said, okay, well, what if every location in our book, What if our book is half adventure and half setting, and every single location gets an adventure? But the adventures will look at the content and say, well, we let the content speak to us. This needs a little bit longer. This needs a little bit shorter. And what emerged from that was encounters that you could kick off a campaign with in a day, in one session, things that would be like 1 to 2 sessions before you could finish them, and something that would be 2+, you know, maybe 2, maybe 3, at most 4 sessions. And so we said, hey, look, we've got 3 lengths here just by the nature of the content. We've identified 14, and then we came across war, Roan came across war horror, and that makes 15 kinds of horror. What if we just identify the intensity and the reasons why we think it's intense? Well, now we can say it's this type, it's this intensity and this length. Pick the adventure that you want. They're all labeled this way. And now you'll know what you're getting into.
Yeah, that's great. That's very, yeah, very helpful for a group to figure out where they're going.
We ran the, if you take Abattoir 8, which is our free adventure written by Richard Pett, it's his first ever Starfinder and first ever space horror adventure, but he's sort of a path master of horror for Pathfinder. If you look at that adventure, on the back of it, you'll see all the 15 kinds of horror, and you'll see like 2 of them are lit up. I think it's slasher and survival for that one. Mm-hmm. And we were a little nervous running with that as our first one, even though Rich Pett is such an original and interesting designer, because we didn't want people to think, oh, that's all this is. This is just slasher fiction. This is just, you know, this is just a blood fest. And of course, we wanted to be original within that genre. But while we were playtesting it, we got a little nervous because in the playtest, people aren't picking and choosing. They're just playtesting what we hand them. So there were some people at that table who were like partway in the adventure. They're like, nope, 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 nope. No, no, don't like this. No, you know, and we get playtest feedback like, this is awesome. This is incredible. This is the best thing ever. Oh my God, I never want to play this again. And it wasn't until we came to recognize, oh, right, that person, we asked a few questions and they're like, oh yeah, I don't like horror. Okay, maybe you weren't the playtester for the horror adventure, but yeah, that was a little challenge. You can get that adventure for free too. If you go to the Grimmerspace Kickstarter at grimmerspace.com, half a little bit down the page, is downloads this adventure for free, you know, during the Kickstarter. It's the one you guys played. You playtested.
Yes, we
you
did.
Ran a live session of that, right? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and we let people know that it's there for free. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was watching and it was late, and then I gotta confess, I just passed out because it was like 1 in the morning or something over here. Did your group get to the point in the adventure where they were looking into the meat processing plant?
Not quite. Yeah. We were kind of on our way to the control room. We were going up the kind of umbilical to the control room.
Okay. So you decided to take the dark corridor.
Yes.
Yeah, we just found out. I think we ended on a little bit of a cliffhanger. We got a life reading that the person or the thing in the gap.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
That's where I got. I did a roll 20 actual play the other day, and that's where we got to. So a lot of people went into. They checked out the other two corridors, and they walked into either automated harvesting or meat processing. A lot of people walked into meat processing, and I read the read aloud, and they're like, "Nah." Turn around, going back. Harvesting sounds good. That sounds like plants. Right. I'm down with plants.
No, we thought that, yeah, the text that's in the adventure, well, of course, we didn't read it because our game master read it to us, but it really set the scene really, really nicely.
Thank you. Thank you. We worked hard over that with what Rich gave us. You know, it's always your designer does their handover, and especially with Rich Pet, it's always inventive and unusual and like, oh my God, how did he come up with that? But then you have to really get in there and edit it to perfection. You know, you got to get it just right.
Yeah, but like, I guess in the box sex debate, it's definitely one for the 4 column. Yeah,
right.
It's really good.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Rich Pet puts pigs into everything that he writes. In one way, it's like one of those Easter eggs. If you read any of his award-winning stuff, there's always some pig in there somewhere. We don't have Earth animals. Mm-hmm. We don't have any Terran references, no Earth references, no Earth animals. We try to keep any strictly Earth metaphors to a minimum. It's one of our design guides. So when he wrote pigs into the abattoir, we're like, it can't be a pig. And so that's what prompted us to create the Thunk.
Nice.
We needed a space ungulate.
Our GM, Jackson, he ended up voicing Thrask somewhere between Sling Blade and kind of a Fargo accent.
Nice.
So that character, how did you imagine him sounding when you were, when things were kind of coming together?
Sling Bladey.
Oh, nice.
Sling Bladey has always been sort of the guiding thing, and just not nice at heart like Sling Blade. So Sling Bladey, and then I never would have thought to add a Fargo accent. That's fantastic. I'm giving it up for that. That must have been wonderful.
Nice. Yeah, we'll let Jackson know.
Now I'm always like, meat, you know.
Swedish chef.
yeah, a little bit like an overgrown Swedish chef with anger issues.
Well, what would be one piece of general advice you would give a GM just running a horror game?
Slow. A mistake I used to make early on until a better GM than I corrected it was rushing to the reveal, not letting the creepiness percolate long enough to get under people's skin, and of course short enough that nobody gets bored. Mm. And you've got to build the sense of mood and build the sense of horror one element at a time. If you rush into the action, you're not going to achieve like that friction of fear that makes the hair stand on end or the goosebumps come up. So pacing is super important in a horror adventure, I think.
Mm.
Once all heck breaks loose, now you're on the thrill ride, and that's a different kind of horror. That's more thriller at that point.
Mm. An interesting thing that came up is, so in the GM instructions in the adventure says that the GM should not call for perception rolls as people are exploring, that the player should announce what they're looking for. And that's kind of an older style of play. And is that intentional to kind of maintain the tension and kind of hide surprises?
Yes. It is because that's exactly right. You know, and one of the other options I think listed in there was that the GM could ask for 10 perceptions like pre-rolled.
Oh, right.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then you just have a chart with a list of everyone's pre-rolled perception checks. And every time the GM needs one, instead of asking the player, they just look to the column of the row and check it off. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise, when you have things that are going to startle people or you have things that are going to be a surprise and you say, hey, give me a perception check. And then everyone in the room is like, I'll check too. You know, and suddenly there's no surprise, you know.
Yes.
So I personally, I like the pre-roll 10 perception checks, pre-roll stealth check. I like the pre-rolling of multiple mm-hmm. different kinds of checks so that I can just keep the narrative flow going smoothly.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's a great strategy.
And then players walking down, I go, hey, you know, Ed notices in the wall that's not just a scratch mark. Those are words spelling out his name.
Yes. So do you have a preference when you're doing the work that you did for Paizo in fantasy, did you like horror settings as well? Or was this kind of new for you doing horror for role
We've
play.
Always had horrific elements. So Roan and I are just kind of not right that way. It just goes there, whether we want it to or not. We haven't had horror settings. I mean, I did write a horror adventure for Call of Cthulhu called Snows of an Early Winter. And it's when I give seminars on nonlinear adventure design, it's one of the things I use as an example. So I had written horror before. This was modern urban horror. Roan's written a ton of horror, both in short fiction and in adventure. But usually with the work to speak to your question, usually the work in Pathfinder or other role-playing game systems, we're not deciding the setting. We're writing an adventure in somebody else's setting. So we don't get to make that call, but the horror creeps in anyway. Like, for example, Roan and I wrote an adventure called Citadel of Pain, and we didn't name that. We wrote an adventure called Citadel of Pain for Gaming Paper, our very good friends over at Gaming Paper. And Eric Bauer had us this thing called the Mega Dungeon, where he had printed out on 8.5 by 11 squares, sections of dungeon with exit points. And then you would assemble like 100 of them and make something the size of like a 9-foot by 7-foot rug of dungeon crawl. He said, hey guys, here. I'm like, what am I supposed to do with this, Eric? And he's like, I want you and Roan to write an adventure for it. Wow. Like, oh my God. So in doing that, we created this underground world that people get trapped in. I won't get into too many crazy details, but couldn't resist some horror elements. So there's a locked door and you can peer through the keyhole. And years and years ago, when this whole thing was sealed up, and a mad alchemist had been experimenting, and one of the things he was experimenting on was a unicorn. And unicorns are immortal. So this unicorn's been locked in a closet, like, since the disaster that took out, you know, that buried the citadel. And it's just been in there for like a century. So it's gone mad. And which is pretty horrific on its own. But when I finally ran the game at Gen Con for a special group, the party got a little separated. The first person came around the corner. They saw this ornate lock and door, filigree, etc. And they bent down and they looked into the keyhole. And what I had written was, anyone who looks through the keyhole gets a unicorn horn in the eye. So he sits down and he looks through this keyhole, wham, right into his head. Dead. Massive damage rule. Boom, dead. Right. And then so the body falls and I'm like, okay, you cannot say a word. You have to just be quiet. And then the next party member walks around the corner and sees the corpse of his friend in front of the door. So he runs up and he checks the door for traps, rolls super high. There are no traps.
Right.
It's just a keyhole. So he looks through it. Bam, unicorn horn in the eye. A few minutes later, the next party member walks around the corner. Two corpses in front of a door. Got the entire party.
Wow.
Totally unintentional. Mad unicorn locked in a closet for a century. Just a horrific thing. Piled up a stack of five corpses. End of adventure. Because they couldn't stop themselves from looking in the keyhole. And I'm like, how is that not every horror movie? Where you know, like, I shouldn't look in the keyhole. But I'm going to look in the keyhole. That's great.
And I think we got off lucky in Abattoir 8 with that.
Yeah, it's a little slasher and survival horror. It's a little more part two of Abattoir 8, which the Kickstarter has enabled us to create, you know, to, and they'll fold together into one adventure called Casket of the Cull. But part two is body horror, a little bit of cosmic horror, and so the horror tone shifts.
Mm-hmm. No.
I think it gets worse. I mean, better. Depends how you look at it. Wham! Unicorn horn in the eye.
Oh, and I saw that for Abattoir 8, and it was a stretch goal, I think, that was unlocked. You're going to be including it for Roll 20. So anybody that has the digital level or higher will have that available to them in Roll 20.
That's correct. They will get a Roll 20 key. The Roll 20 conversion is already done. It's what I was playing with the other night. The fellow who did it, Brian Criswell, is just marvelous. Marvelous guy. Nice. He's so good at that. So he converted the entire thing in a week.
Wow. That's great. Do you want to talk a little bit about the books that are available and how things are presented on the Kickstarter? There were a few questions we had about some of the items that you're offering.
Sure. Go right ahead.
So what about the Xeno and the Denizen decks? How do those work as far as in the Grimmer space?
Right. Play? So they're a convenience tool for the GM. Mm-hmm. Every monster that's in the Xenophiles, every monster that we create, and every monster that's in the Xenophiles book, which is our bestiary, it's our monster manual, mm-hmm. will also have a tarot-sized, not playing card, but tarot-sized card in the Xeno deck. And the purpose, and that they're laminated, they're water-resistant, they're Mountain Dew-resistant, you know. Their point is, you know, you got your monster embedded into your adventure, whether digital or print, and now the players are fighting it and they move somewhere else and they maybe fight, you know, you don't want to flip back and forth between that book. Like, oh, hang on, wait 1 second while I go to the next section. So with the cards, the GM could just pull out the cards, show the art to the players because that's on one side for each individual monster, then put the monster card down next to them and stay focused in the adventure and not have to flip back and forth all the time. That's really its purpose.
Oh, that's great.
But yeah, that showing aspect, that's pretty important. Well, it's pretty important in any game, but I guess especially in horror, just drink it in. This is what you see.
Right, right. You need little things that help. There's so many little things that interrupt the flow of a game mm-hmm. that we get used to and we just accept. And, you know, we have our conversation with our friends while we're waiting. But in a horror game, you especially, yeah. and a lot of games, but in a horror game especially, you want that pacing and that flow. So yeah. we try to create tools in the adventures and external like products that will just make it all go smoother. And we're not the first person to do that deck-wise. Other people have done it, but we thought it was a good idea. Mm. And the Denizen deck is similar. The Denizen deck is everything you can talk to that isn't a monster. Mm. that's in the adventures. All the NPCs, all the almost monsters who will have a conversation with you, all of those beings you can hold up and say, this is who you're talking to, and put it right down next to you, and you don't have to flip back and forth in the book.
Mm, nice. And then, so you said the Xenophiles is your monster manual, basically. And
correct.
Then what will be available in the Setting and Adventures main book? That looks like a pretty sizable volume.
Sure. That's the core book, and we're solidly on track. It started out as a 128-page book, which, you know, we would have been content to make, but it's very close to the thing that we've always imagined we would make at 256 pages. So the first thing is, like I mentioned earlier, it's half setting and half adventures. Mm-hmm. So there's 14, 16, I apologize, I'm not recalling the exact number. It's something like 14 different locations in the galaxy, in the Gliding Rim or world of Grimmer Space. And that divides into our five polities, or sort of central star nations, that are the places player characters are likely from. That's Technic civilization at the center. The Gliding Rim galaxy is set up like a vortex. Think of it at the top of it like a plate. Mm-hmm. The center of that plate is the crux, and that's where the polities are. The crux polities that people come from, they're five main places. They're in the center. So you push out toward the edge of that top plate, or the top of the vortex, you're going toward the edge. That's where everything gets darker and stranger, more difficult, where they try to establish colonies. Some succeed, some fail. Everything below that, twisting below that in our imaginary tornado, is the gyre. And no one returns from the gyre, you know? Mm. Or if they do, they're only pretending to be your friend. They're really something else. That's where there'd be dragons. So there are five polities, and they're each going to get a location setting description in the book, and then a whole bunch of locations on the edge. Every single location gets an adventure. There's no such thing in the book as a location described in the setting that doesn't have an adventure. So this helps us avoid creating like run-on encyclopedia entries that, you know, take you five sessions sitting on the toilet to get through. Mm. Instead, you get the core information you really need to ground you, and then you get an adventure to let everyone live through it. And then it's going to have a whole raft of other sections, like, you know, travel in Grimmer Space, or the races, the classes, the technologies, starships, NPCs that, you know, are traveling around the galaxy, organizations that players can belong to or become an enemy of, et cetera, et cetera.
Nice.
Are there any differences between starships in Grimmer Space and, I guess, the default setting of Starfinder?
Yes. Yes. The Starfinder default role-playing game setting.
Yes. Okay. It just rolls off the tongue.
I give Eric Mona such a hard time about that. He's writing our forward, and he's a friend, and every time, your license makes me say this, Eric. It's your fault. Yes, there is. First of all, we're going to be inventing, I've already started inventing, Grimmer Space specific technology. And that's not just for players, but for starships as well.
Oh, okay.
And each starship is going to, each polity will have its own special technologies that only belong to that polity. So it'll make each starship from a different polity, you know, a little bit special. But travel actually was a big one, because if you recall, we said magic is leaking into the galaxy for the first time.
Uh-huh.
But the drift drive of the default Starfinder role-playing game setting is magical.
Mm.
So that means that whatever was making ships fly around Grimmer Space before the Sunder Mages show up, there has to be something that's not magical. Mm. It's got to be different from the drift drive.
Wow.
You know, nice. So there has to be something. So, you know, jump drive technology is a staple. You know, you can find that on TV tropes if you look up science fiction. So we're inventing our own version of jump drive technology, something that is that's not magical, that's not going into another dimension inhabited by beings, you know, in order to travel faster than light. And we have to do that as a reasonable armchair extrapolation from real science. And so we've come up with something. And then that had implications and ramifications, because suddenly, you know, how much fuel you have, how much air you have, how much food you need to travel from point to point becomes much more important. And at the same time, you don't want some stupid bookkeeping system. You know, it's not like, I got to open my spreadsheet to play my role-playing game.
Right.
Mm. You know? Yeah. So I don't know if you saw, we made a poster map to handle that.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, you'll see there's a 24 by 36 navigation map. Mm-hmm. It shows the map of the Crux and the Edge. And while it's still in development, what you're going to be able to do is take a string or a ruler and put it, I'm going to go from here to here, and then move that ruler or string over to the to the charts on the side that are organized by ship tier, and the length will just tell you, oh, that's how much food I need, that's how much fuel I need, that's how much air I need.
Oh, that sounds fun.
Yeah. It's got like, it shows the areas of all the polities and what they control and where they've established colonies. And then it has a table that shows common destinations, you know, like Adium Prime to Somnia. And it's just written there in the chart already, you know, this much food, this much air, this much fuel. And we even invented a coordinate system that will actually works. So at the beginning of Star Trek or something here, star date, you know, such and such and such and such, we're in the so-and-so sector 432, you know, and it's always something nonsense that doesn't mean anything. So on this map, and we had to come up with a new one because no Earth stuff, right? The outer circle is divided in numerically, and then it's divided into pie slices. And then through the center, there's a line with letters. So you get, you know, latitude, longitude circles, concentric circles. And you can say, I'm in circle 14 to 15, sector H. And then each of those sectors is divided 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, through 10. So sector H.9. And then you can say 4,333 light years positive conviction relative, meaning picking the closest celestial body and stating whether you're above the plane or below the plane in light years. And that will actually get you really, really close to where the sector that someone really is. Wow. And you can actually have a coordinate reference system for the map that works.
Oh, nice.
And you can find stuff on it.
That's great. Yeah, nice. I know you got a little bit of pressure in the comments on the Kickstarter, maybe to release the classes, the original classes that you're doing for Grimmer Space a little bit earlier. And I saw that you and Roan did videos.
Correct.
For those. Can you talk a little bit about those?
Sure. So, you know, we actually started out with the intention of keeping player options to a minimum. Mm-hmm. And the reason was when we first started talking about it and thinking about this, it was still, Starfinder was a year old. People hadn't really played it a lot. And they were like, we've got plenty of player options to work through in the core book. We don't need third parties making up new stuff.
Right.
Now that changed over the next 2 years. Mm-hmm. And then also, you start making your setting and it's kind of inescapable. The material itself starts demanding that there's a class right there. It's in front of you. You can't avoid inventing it, you know? Mm-hmm. So each of our Crux polities has given rise to a class. So there is, let's see, there is the RCOP from the Adian Combine. Mm-hmm. The Adian Combine has an overpopulation problem, and everyone lives in arcologies, buildings that house a population the size of a nation and rise up into the stratosphere so you can see them from space. The planet looks jewel covered. But someone's got to police that madness. And so you get the arcology cop. Mm-hmm. And the arcology cop, think of this as the place where you would have like Judge Dredd or the Raid.
Yeah.
In an arcology, that kind of horror. Well, the arcology cop and the lowest levels of an arcology are all dirt poor, and the highest levels, they're literally, you know, floating in low gravity. Mm-hmm. They're so exalted. Well, the arcology cop has a piece, has a weapon. Mm-hmm. And that weapon is special in the sense that it contains the mind, the literal mind of a dead RCOP, of a previous RCOP. You know,
oh, nice.
Didn't just donate my spleen to, you know, organ harvesting. I donated my brain. Mm-hmm. And as the arcology cop levels up, the gun's abilities and powers level up. Oh, yeah. Right. So the arcology cop, it has three triggers. You can assign three different kinds of ammunition: crowd control, tranquilizing, and, you know, kill that guy. Nice. And you can mix and match how it's going to be set up, and you get multi attacks from the triggers. But mostly, it's a cop buddy movie,
right?
Because you're like, you're gonna go left, and your gun's like, no, that's a bad idea, go right. So, you know, and then that connects over to another place called the Eminent Spectrality, because the RCOPs have to go there in a ceremony to get the other RCOP inserted into their gun and get the bonding set up, you know.
Hmm.
And the Eminent Spectrality is where we have gothic horror. It's a very ritualized culture. It's dominated by houses seeking life extension through biotechnology, but they're also extremely superstitious. From there arises a character class called the Recombinator. And the Recombinator is a little bit like a biological mechanic, but instead of building a drone, the Recombinator whips out their DNA lab and invents new life forms to serve it.
Yeah, nice.
And so you just, much like a mechanic, as the Recombinator levels up, so too does their ability to create more and more horrific servitor life forms and DNA extensions and blend their biology into the things that they create. So as Roan put it, you fight horror by creating lab spawned horrors of your own.
Nice.
Yeah. I think that's actually a good way to think of it. I think we've all heard that, yea, though I walked into the valley of the shadow of death, I will feel no evil, for I'm the meanest son of a bitch in the whole damn valley.
Nice.
That is probably a good, you could put that on a plaque and stick that under Grimmer Space, you know?
Nice.
So that's the Recombinator from the Eminent Spectrality. Mm-hmm. If you move over to the Somnium Meld, you get a character class called the Quantum Seer. And the Quantum Seer, I'm trying to think of the best way to encapsulate a big thing and put it in a little box. The Somnium Meld is a place where everyone is connected through a direct neural interlink. Mm-hmm. Originally for joint research purposes while sleeping, you know, we wanted, I'll go to sleep and you can keep working on the science project we were working on. Yeah.
Mm.
The original inventors of the technology went into their shared connective neural space only to see that there was yet another layer, another quantum layer at which humanity was already connected, was already direct neural interlinked. They had physically visited or mentally visited the collective unconscious. And so they uploaded themselves into this quantum realm and became the dreaming gods of the dream magi of the Somnium Meld. And they're sort of godlike figures now that influence whole swaths of population from somewhere deep in the collective unconscious. So a quantum seer is part of the Somnium Meld. They're part of this uplink technology. And they have the ability that not everyone has to be able to peer into this quantum realm. And because the quantum reflects and changes, I should say, when you stare at it, it collapses probability states when you stare at it, they are able to generate by reflection a quantum replica of everything they are or are not. Their inner darkness, so to speak, their neuroses and their problems. And since quantum make up the constituent blocks of reality, they are able by an act of psionics and mental discipline and sitting on the edge, staring into the abyss, to manifest the horror within and make it the horror without.
Wow.
And then set it to crushing their enemies and punching noses and stuff like that.
Right. Oh, that's great.
Wow. So it's a little hard to explain.
Yes,
it's a little challenging, but you get it the second you see what I've Raiden Chen's amazing artwork of this woman suspended inside the kind of globule monster that she's manifested from the quantum realm.
Oh, that's great.
And there's more to it. There are side effects. There are challenges to using it. But that's the character class that comes out of the Somnium Meld. Mm-hmm. We have the Crypto Monk. Largely originating in Gylor, but that's a little... It's a little bit of a setting secret as to how accurate that is. So, Crypto Monk sitting at home, kind of going dark web, poking around message boards, finds a message board that says, you know, we may think that the Votigans have and other polities have fought back the stuff that comes out of the gyre, but that's all garbage. The aliens have really slipped in among us and are already possessing people, right? Mm-hmm. So this is a common sci-fi trope, right? Common sci-fi horror trope. Your neighbor, Mrs. Wu, really has an alien parasite. The senator is really, you know, alien infected. So the Crypto Monk is poking around this dark web message board and then discovers that everyone else poking around it are being gifted or downloaded with plans for technology that shouldn't work, but for some reason it does. And you can make it out of everything. So you can make it out of your microwave, you know, a bicycle wheel, insert non-Earth things, but you can make it out of household items. Mm-hmm. And suddenly you have a pair of goggles that can see the parasite wrapped around Mrs. Wu's spine.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Right. And that also hands down instruction manuals for fighting techniques, for chi-based fighting techniques, that if you hit Mrs. Wu in the right complex of nerves, it'll set up a chain reaction within her body that like ejects the parasite.
Nice. Wow.
That's just an example. That's a very specific example, but there's a whole range. They become not just a Xeno seeker or Xeno hunter, but martial arts equipped and able to make technologies from scrap that enable them to fight aliens. Nice. better than anyone else. It's a setting secret who set up this message board and where all this technology and fighting styles are coming from.
Mm. Mm.
So there's the Crypto Monk. There's salvaging companies. There's organizations. Each of the policies gave rise to organizations as well. The players can join and get enhancements. There's mm-hmm. So then there's a Vodigan Marine.
Mm-hmm.
Again, everything is tightly tied to the polity that it rises out of. So this polity is, there was a water world, and long ago, something called the Benefactor arrived on it. You can see a picture of this on the Kickstarter's giant column of water going into the sky.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, those Kandaran sea people would occasionally go into that column. And when they came out, they were suddenly enlightened with technological developments or social developments. They were, you know, suddenly Gandhi, or they were, you know, Isaac Newton. And in short order, the Benefactor uplifts the Kandaran people to space. They go across to the first planet in their binary system, and it's a heavy world, volcano-ridden, heavy gravity place where the Vodi are. And the two of them make nice, and they have great trade, and they become a single culture, Vodi and Kundara, Vodikun. And this Vodikun Empire has marines, mostly from Vodi, who have a back-mounted, automated chain gun kind of weapon. Mm-hmm. The nickname is Cannonbacks. And through a mental discipline, they're able to assign various elements of the Starfinder action economy to different features of the weapon.
Oh, nice.
So as they go up in levels, they mm-hmm. can be like, okay, of the multi-shots I have, these are assigned to my reactions, and these are going to be instead of a move. And if this happens, these ones will go off. And they can turn themselves, and what they do largely is sacrifice parts of their movement to do that, until they become these kind of automated battle platforms, or as we call it, walking war.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
And there's more complexity there, and some of it's still under development, but that's it, I think. That's what we have for... I feel like I'm missing one. I'm going to get off of this, and Rowan's going to call me up and be like, you fool. You know,
we'll refer people to those videos, because I think you guys do a great job of describing things. So yeah, thank you for making those, because that is a great series of kind of discussions of the places and the classes and things. So yeah, we'll make sure we get a link to those.
All right, cool.
Great. And so in the player's guide itself, so you've got like a 32-page player's book. So what's included in there? Basically character creation and kind of, because it wouldn't be the Starfinder mechanics. It would just be the setting specific.
Yeah, it's the setting specific mechanics. If you got the core book and it's got all the classes in it and everything else, but you have five other people at the table.
Mm, right.
Four other people at the table. So are we going to take the one core book and pass it around all the time?
We have that's done gonna.
Yeah, I mean, we all have, right? We all have. And it's going to interrupt the flow of the game and the pacing that we were talking about earlier. So the player's guides are 32-page soft cover, saddle-stitched, I think they're mm-hmm. saddle-stitched, duplications of the player-only and player-specific material, so you don't have to do that.
Mm, great.
They're a table aid, much the way the decks are, to make the game easier. That's why you'll see some levels have like four of them,
mm-hmm.
one for every person at your table.
Yes. Oh, and what about the Immersive Battle Maps book? I think I saw, is this the same company that did a Kickstarter previously?
Yep.
For fantasy?
Yes, okay. Yarrow Studios. So he wanted to do a space book, mm-hmm. and we were talking with him about it, and we decided to do it within the Grimmer Space Kickstarter. So it's the same exact guy, Yarrow Studios. Tanner's just really fantastic.
Nice.
His very first space book of battle map, immersive battle maps that you can open up, and it always lays flat and nothing spills on it, and you can write on it with marker, and the maps are gorgeous, and it's not available anywhere else right now except on Kickstarter.
Nice. Oh, great. Yeah, it looks beautiful. Yeah, you've got a nice shot of that in the video. That's good.
And keep an eye out. We got an update coming where it's going to get a facelift, And we already had an update that there's a 4-page foldout in the center of it that's a ship from Grimmer Space.
Oh, nice.
There's going to be an update. In fact, I was writing the update earlier today. Yeah.
Oh, great. And after your description of the ARCOP class, I noticed that you've got the prop, you've got the actual gun. And I think that that's a great piece for at least the flavoring of that character class.
Yeah, it's really fun. We had it. I saw the work of this guy on the Starfinder Facebook group, mm-hmm. and he had made a replica of, Jay Smith's his name, he made a replica of Decker's gun from Blade Runner.
Oh, nice.
And it was just perfect. And mm-hmm. I'm like, that's amazing. So we got a hold of him, and he took the commission, and he's going to, for everyone who gets that, he's going to hand make a movie quality model prop of the ARCOPS piece.
Wow.
And send them an individual one. And
nice.
Yeah. And we had that at PaizoCon during our launch party. And, you know, at first no one wanted to touch it because what if I damage it? But you can't really. It's really very well made and then hand painted, et cetera, et cetera. So once people got a hold of it, we couldn't get it out of their hands. Mm-hmm. Like, I know how much Owen Steffens, the Starfinder lead designer, I'm like, Owen, you need to give that back now. Owen.
Well, it looks like you guys are doing really well. The Kickstarter is going gangbusters. You're at like 1,200% over your original goal. So
yes. Yeah,
wonderful.
Fingers crossed. I very much want to, I don't want this to sound greedy because it's not based on that. I want to get it above the 200,000 mark because we have some really amazing things planned that I want to make, I want to create for people, but we have to get higher to be able to reach them. So,
right. We've got about 10 days to go, and I think you're getting good attention, and hopefully this conversation will bring some more attention to the project.
Yes, so pay attention to us.
Yes. So you discussed previously that you just need the Starfinder core book or the starter set, and both of those are available as pledge levels on the...
That's correct. We, as a convenience to backers, just like we had a lot of people who said that they were going to try Kickstarter for the first time, we had a fair number of people who've been thinking about Starfinder. So we created two backer levels, one where we figure it's for people, doesn't have to be this way, but we figure it's for people who've never played a role-playing game before. It includes the Starfinder beginner box. You just get it right there on the Kickstarter. And then there's another level that includes the Starfinder core rulebook. If you've been Starfinder curious, we call it.
You know. So, it's been great talking to you. And I really appreciate you making the time, especially on Japan time.
Nah, no worries. My pleasure. And thanks for running the game.
Oh, yeah. We really enjoyed that. That was a real surprise because we weren't quite sure what to expect with a, you know, sci-fi horror setting. And it was really fun. And I think specifically the mechanics of Starfinder work well with how you've set things up, because especially at level one, once we started losing hit points and had no stamina left, it did become kind of run and gun and hide and figure out how we're going to beat Thrask.
Meaty, don't run around. My favorite line I've come up with when running that adventure is, stop pretending you're not meat.
Yes. Nice. Yeah, that was themed really, really great. I enjoyed that.
Great, I'm glad.
Take a look at Grimmer Space on Kickstarter. How about the future of Grimmer Space? What kinds of things, once people back this project in Kickstarter, what kinds of things in the future are you thinking about?
We have only just begun.
Excellent.
We have only just begun. We have many plans. One of the things that's not in this yet mm-hmm. is like an AP covering the central tension of the setting. Mm. So that's certainly something we're kicking around. Grimmer Space itself, the Gliding Rim Galaxy, is huge. We have only touched, like, you could have an entire campaign in one arcology and never leave it if that's what you wanted to do. There is just so much room and so many possibilities that we certainly intend on creating more adventures.
Excellent.
We have some plans that I was alluding to earlier about that I hope we can do this Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. That would expand player options even more. And some of it, we're going to wait and see what the amazing luminaries who've promised to do some writing for us, what mm-hmm. they come up with.
Oh, excellent.
See what the material itself tells us needs to be brought into the world, because that usually happens when you create, you know, you start seeing, oh, yeah, and this, oh, yeah, and that.
One more question from the podcast. Everyone is dying to know. What is your favorite Sean Astin movie?
Ha! There's so many of them. They're so good. There is this one scene I always tease Sean about when we see him. In 51st Dates, he has this thing where he makes his pec muscles move independently because he plays like the annoying younger brother.
Right.
Of the female lead. So I tell him that's my favorite movie moment of his, which just gets him to like kind of glare at me. It's got to be Lord of the Rings is just so iconic, so inescapable.
Oh, yeah.
Rudy is off the hook. You know, I loved him in Stranger Things.
Yeah, that was a good, nice surprise.
You know, he there's that scene in Stranger Things. This is won't spoil it for anyone, but there's a scene in Stranger Things where they're thinking about watching a movie and someone suggests a horror movie. And Sean goes, oh, no, I don't like horror movies. That's real. That's actually real. It's not that he doesn't like them. It's that he's very affected by them. You know, some people are very affected by horror movies. He gets really creeped out. And for the guy who's been in The Strain, that was so, it's so awesome to spook him out. Like you can really get him. Yeah. I mean, I got to get Rudy. The Goonies, come on. Yeah. I don't want to say that his earliest work is my favorite because then it'd be like, oh, thanks. Although he's immensely proud and rightly so, of course, of the Goonies, but you know, that's just become iconic. Yeah, I'm a Sean Astin fan. Don't tell him. He was working on a movie project, a script written by a friend of mine and who had brought in my aunt to be the dramaturge on this out in LA. Ron and I were working on another role-playing game project that we're still working on other than, you know, outside of this Kickstarter. And we wanted a celebrity attached. And I mentioned in passing to Roan that, hey, my aunt's working with Sean Astin. And I have two famous-ish aunts in the music industry and the world of acting and whatnot. Hi, Katie. Hi, Mary Jo. I love them. And Roan goes, well, why aren't we asking Sean Astin? Because he's like perfect for this project. And I'm like, oh, you know, it's my aunt's connection and my friend's project. And then I'd be sort of like poaching and I don't really want to. And he's like, slap. Just, do you think your friend and your aunt will love you less if you ask? No. So you don't get if you don't ask. Just ask the right way. And I'm like, okay, you're right. So I screwed up my courage with Roan's support and prompting. That's an ongoing theme in our friendship. Yeah, then I asked her if she would make the introduction. If Tom, my friend Tom would make the introduction. He said, sure. And we talked to Sean and he loved our project. And that led to us like pitching stuff out in Hollywood together. And we became friends over the course of that. He's very involved too. You know, he's a creative developer. He's going to review the material, already has, and gives us feedback on it creatively, helps it become more cinematic. And he's a real creative powerhouse. You know, you can't always catch him. You know, sometimes he's reading the stuff on the plane and getting us the feedback in notes, but it's always powerful and it's always transformative. So it's great to work with him. When this project came along, we were like, we called him up again and we had all these ideas about trying to make it work for him. But it's like, that's like trying to give the guy who's everything something for Christmas, you know? And he's like, wait, stop. Story's worthy. You're worthy. Your stories are worthy. Of course I'll help out with this. And that's just who he is. You know, he really believes in the transformative power of story to shape lives.
And we've got well over.
Well, it's been really great talking to you, and we're really excited about the project, and people should definitely check out Grimmer Space.
All right, well, thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it.
For RPGs.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.